I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to the Badass Women's Hour podcast with me, Harriet Minter, Natalie Campbell and Emma Sexton. Now, usually we have new guests for you, but this week the radio show got bumped for Brexit. Of course it did. So instead we're bringing you two of our favourite interviews from the last 6 months. First up, it's Carrie Gracie talking about taking on the BBC. And then we have Mandy Reid from the Women's Equality Party.
Underwear, armpit hair, many imitators, but no one compares.
Badass Women's Hour XL with Harriet Minter, Natalie Campbell and Emma Sexton on Talk Radio.
One, two, three, four!
One of our absolute heroines fighting this battle for us is a BBC editor, presenter, all-round absolute badass, Carrie Gracie. Hello, welcome to the studio.
Hello.
Standing ovation, standing ovation. Oh, wow, that's
so, Carrie, back in January 2018, you essentially became probably the most high-profile unequal pay case out there. What made you decide to go public with it?
We have been fighting, trying to talk reason to our bosses, and that was a lot of us by then, women at the BBC, because I was one of many. And we'd been trying to make a reason argument, talk sense, talk about the values of the BBC plus the law, and we weren't getting anywhere. And just got to the point where I thought, do you know what? If you think about history, how many times in a big fight over power, money, status have men given women, or bosses, powerful people, given women things without them having to fight it? I think at the end of the day, you have to work out where your power lies and use it, because making a reasoned argument is not going to win in those circumstances. Yeah. So I decided, look, at that point, I was 55 years old. I've got a body of work. No one can take that away from me. I've got a lot of credibility with my colleagues because I've been there for 30 years. Probably, if anyone's going to do this, I've paid off a lot of my mortgage. My kids are reaching adulthood. If anyone's going to take this risk and go up over the top in this public way, I can do this thing.
So for anyone who isn't aware of your case, set the scene of what was happening.
So the BBC is nearly a century old. And like many organisations and workplaces, I don't have to tell you, I don't have to tell your listeners, it's got a gender pay gap. It's fair to say about the BBC that its gender pay gap is actually smaller than most other media organisations. It's got a lot of women in high-profile jobs, fierce and outspoken women, to its credit. And in a way, that was the problem. It had put enough women into, or not enough, but put some women into high-profile roles, but then it hadn't played them equally. A weird thing happened, because it is a public service broadcaster, and because Parliament was getting fed up and the government was getting fed up with the pay of senior managers and senior stars at the BBC, and got to the point where in 2017 the BBC was forced to publish the pay that was higher than the Prime Minister. So it came out along with the annual report on the 19th of July. I don't think anyone involved expected events to happen in the way that they did, because women just looked at it and went, oh my word, I'm doing the same job as him. And I've been told for years that I was paid equally, or roughly equally, and I'm clearly not. So what on earth is going on? And I was one of those women to whom that happened. And I suppose in my case, there was I mean, everyone's got an individual bit of their pay story, haven't they? There's some things that are structural and affect all of us, and then there are some things that are individual. And in my case, I had been sent off to China 4 years earlier to do this really quite hard job, in my view. Spoke Chinese, had been, you know, in and out of China for 30 years by that stage. I was in a field of about one in terms of people who could do the job that I was doing as the BBC's first China editor. And at the point that I was appointed, I said, look, if you want me to do this job, because I didn't actually apply for it. And in fact, I had turned it down and they kept pushing. And I said, if you want me to do this job, I have a couple of conditions. And one of them is that you pay me equally because it is a big job. One of the reasons I'm going to do it is because I want women to be seen doing big on-air reporter roles, just like the men. And therefore, you are going to pay me equally. And so 4 years later, when I turned around and discovered that the North America editor was being paid possibly nearly twice as much as me, he was in that band that was between 200 and 250,000. I was earning 134,000. It's a lot of money. I had no problem with my salary, but I really did have a problem with the inequality.
Yes.
And I think that's such an interesting thing about your case, which is I remember reading about it and you were like, no, I am not interested in the money. This is not about you paying me more. This is about you paying me equally for the job I'm doing. And I think so often when women talk about the pay gap, go, oh, women here, you just want a bit more money. And it's actually, we really don't. I really don't want more money. I just want to be paid equally.
So it's you make a really good point because it was quite complex. It is complex. Across the BBC, there are some people who are high profile and naturally the media focuses on them, you know, the big name presenters, and they are earning a lot of money and it is a public service broadcaster. And it's easy for the media to focus on them because it wants to talk about the big names, and it's easy for the enemies and kind of backlash lobby to want to talk about them because they go, oh, they're just spoilt princesses, they're ungrateful, people in public service shouldn't be earning so much anyway. And that kind of muddies the argument because actually we were fighting for the hundreds of thousands of women in the BBC who are don't have the profile and are often on, you know, 22,000, 23,000, you know, they're not earning a lot of money and they're being paid less than a man. And the point needed to be made that this was an argument about principle.
And what was the response when you went to your boss and said, I've seen these, let's have a chat about principle?
Well, I think it's kind of hard for bosses because I think in this, the BBC is just like workplaces across this country and across this world. Bosses, and obviously a lot of bosses are men, not all, but bosses I see as like ostriches with their head in the sand and a big Jenga tower on their back when it comes to pay. And their pay structures are incredibly vulnerable often because they literally have not been done with criteria of fairness, value, the law, actually in mind. Because they never expect to have to explain them. Which is one of the problems that I have with pay in our country is it's so taboo. And the secrecy around it and the difficulty of establishing the facts of your pay are so great that women find it very hard to argue with bosses because bosses will just say, yeah, you're paid about equally. And how are you ever going to find out that that's not true? So when we started the conversation, the immediate response, I think, of our boss class was to think, oh, we got this. You know, we've dealt with women on pay issues before. Get them in a corner, divide and rule them, get them down in a silo with an equal pay grievance or whatever it is, or a pay complaint. Tell them all these explanations. We've got a whole list of them. We've rolled them out year after year, decade after decade. He's got more experience than you. You're in development. We're promoting him for potential. It's a legacy issue. You know, the excuses are endless, and they never expect that you're going to have any comeback. And I think what was different about our case, the women at the BBC who came to get together to form this group, BBC Women, was we just go, no. You know, we're done with all of this. We're all going to exchange information. So we all knew the justifications that were being offered to other women. And that meant we could see that in one situation, profile was, was valuable when a man had the profile. If a woman had the profile, it was less valuable. Yeah. When a man had experience or a certain kind of experience, then experience was valuable. When a man had skills, when a man had whatever. So it was like apples are worth this amount, i.e. a lot when a man is an apple, and worth less if a woman is an apple, and oranges are worth more if the man is the orange. So it's like, in other words, there was a gender problem in our view. There was inconsistency about the criteria used. And by mapping it, which we slowly, patiently and very determinedly did over months, we could see that there really was a problem. And we could also see, as the months went past, that our bosses were just not prepared to, you know, reboot the system, which is what we were demanding.
So the thing that stands out for me in that story, and I remember it at the time, but it's more poignant when you say it, is the togetherness. Mm. Because they'd been able to get away with it year after year because they broke you down into individuals. And as an individual, you don't have a voice to say this is wrong. But the togetherness, and maybe was the togetherness a symptom of the time? Did it feel right to come together versus saying, actually, I'm going to fight, you know, by myself or not say anything?
So, yes. I mean, you've got to remember the moment at which this happened is also the Me Too moment.
Mm. Yeah.
And one of the things, so there were a lot of things that were reminiscent for us in that moment, because if you think about that, that also was a story where the Hollywood stars got a lot of the focus, but actually what was incredibly powerful about that story was it rolled through every workplace, every country, every pay grade, and women could start to see a pattern. They could see a pattern in the abuse, which was, well, about all kinds of things that we probably don't have time to get into, but it was also about the ways that workplaces tried to close them down, had tried to close them down. The silence that had been imposed through confidentiality clauses and non-disclosure agreements. And we knew that that had happened on pay, on equal pay issues in our organisation and in other workplaces. So we knew we had to come together in order to fight it. There was no other way. However, you know, workplaces are really determined not to let you fight together. Mm. So they wouldn't allow a group grievance, which the National Union of Journalists tried to mount on behalf of a lot of these women, over 100 women. They just wouldn't tolerate it. So all the cases were broken down one by one, one by one. And we all had to go into our pay negotiations and then our grievances on our own. You could take one person with you. Mm. So, I mean, it was powerful when senior, you know, the top names that you're familiar with, you know, in BBC Radio, Entertainment, Sport News, go walking into a room with a junior producer, and you could see the manager go pale and the HR person tremble at the knees when they saw like a really big name, fierce female presenter going in along somebody junior. And we were making the point, no woman left behind. Yeah. This is a team effort. And we are still making that point day in, day out. And it is a slog. And I would like to say it is too long that women have been doing unpaid work on this to assert the value of their work. I mean, it's a black joke, isn't it, that this is happening still.
What were the men's responses when they found out? Because, you know, it's a very comfortable position. You're a man, you're being paid double than somebody else. It's a, you know, how were they in terms of speaking out and supporting what you're doing or not?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. And that's the whole of Chapter 9 in my book is about the men. And it's quite difficult for me because I actually had to be quite frontal about criticising some men in this, in my story and in the BBC story. And I, what happened early on, and again, I go through this earlier in the book, is that some men tried to engage with the issue and tried to help. And then other men, senior men I'm talking about now, at the very beginning when 44 senior women, News, Entertainment, Sport, wrote an open letter to the Director General and said, you know, you need to sort this out. And there were one or two men, senior men, who wanted to get a men's letter together. I've written about this in chapter one of the book, actually. And then the other men, a lot of them, said, no, let's not rock the boat. This is, you know, a very difficult issue. Let's just not get involved, basically. Mm. And then I knew about this in kind of in my own story because I went to establish the facts of my pay over my own, you know, working life. I started writing to the men that I'd worked alongside saying, I can understand that you might not want to divulge your pay details, but, you know, this has happened to us and we think there is a structural issue in play here and I need to ask. And you're totally at liberty. I completely understand if you don't want to talk about it, but I would really like to ask if you're prepared to share your pay details for this period when we worked together or this period like that we're in now. And, you know, some men shared and other men didn't share. It's life. Some women share and other women don't share. I mean, I don't think it's right to get too, you know, self-righteous or aggrieved or indignant with men who don't share because we're all on a journey in this, aren't we? And, you know, it's again, I've got a lot of advice for men in the book because I think men are often the powerful people in the workplace and men are the powerful people in the pay conversation. And if they get on board and help women, they can actually make change happen so much faster. Mm. And if they don't, they can block change big time. And obviously for them, it's quite difficult because they don't see the problem because they're not the victim of the problem. Yeah. So it's available to them to pretend it's not happening. And that's, I wrote the book for men, at least as much as for women, because I wanted to say, wake up, this is you. This is you in your workplace and the person you work next to. And this is also, you know, your mother, your daughter, you're everybody around you. And it's a case of justice and fairness.
Badass Women's Hour XL on Talk Radio.
She'll get you talking.
Are you talking there about, you know, men kind of feeling like, oh, I don't, it doesn't affect me, therefore I want to stay out of it. But how do you feel about this report that came out a couple of months ago, which is that men now actively almost don't want to work with women? They are, me too, the pay gap, we've apparently scared them so much that they are terrified of mentoring us or supporting us or sponsoring us.
So that's obviously a shame if that happens, and men need to avoid doing that and think about it. I think understanding helps. One of the things that happened to me when I went public, when I did write the open letter, it was in the Times newspaper on the morning when I was presenting the Today programme. It was quite a wild day. And immediately, one of the things that started happening, which was the wildest thing of all, was that I started to get hundreds of emails, messages of one kind, letters through the post, you know, in the post room at the BBC and at home, from other women. Telling me about their stories. So I knew it was in workplaces up and down the country. But it wasn't just women. We counted them up before, because I also did a parliamentary hearing where I had to give evidence on all of this, because Parliament hauled the BBC in to give an account of itself. And so we counted up the letters in January 2018, and three-fifths of them were from women, but two-fifths were from men. There are huge numbers of men out there who support women. Mm. I was really impressed, and actually throughout my fight, again, it's something I talk about at length, is there's so many great men who came in to support us and stand shoulder to shoulder with us. Not necessarily always the ones who felt their pay might be affected by the conversation. You know, your immediate male comparator, as it's called in an equal pay issue, but other men. However, you know, I also do talk about the men who come in to stand alongside the comparators, the women who are fighting an equal pay case. And I think that's really interesting. And I want to get this point across as well, if I can, that men are hugely important to this conversation. If a man can go in to the meeting room alongside a woman and sit alongside in the way that I was describing that senior women did alongside junior women, if a man can go in and do that, that makes an amazingly powerful point. And particularly if that man is the actual male comparator of the women. Because how these conversations go is the woman says, look, my work is valuable. I do this and this. I have this experience. I have these skills. And I've been here for this long and I've been doing X, Y, Z. And the boss and the HR person, if they want to fight this equal pay claim or equal pay conversation, they'll go, yeah, but the man X, Y, Z, he has this experience, he has that profile. All that, all those justifications and defences will come into play. If the man's sitting there and if the man just goes calmly, well, actually, she does the same job as me. She's as good as
game
me,
changer.
Doing the same job as me. Then it moves the woman from square 9 to square 90 on the snakes and ladders board. It is very hard for an employer to contest a woman's claim if the man that she is her comparator, her male peer, is saying, do you know what? Same job. It's just so powerful. And so I would really hope, something I talk about again. I mean, there are men doing this, but not enough.
Negotiating, because there's a lot of conversation around the gender pay gap and about women having better negotiating skills. And I'm thinking about you when you were negotiating your £134,000 salary. You know, you seemed to me as somebody who's confident, you knew your worth. what do you do as a woman when, you know, you think you are confidently negotiating what is a really good salary, but then you realise that there's an awful lot of money still on the table because they've given that to somebody else? Like, what? Because I feel like it's one thing to negotiate really hard, but if you knew there was another 100 grand up for grabs, like, you know, how would you, how do you navigate knowing your worth that way?
So, I think it's the important thing is to start from when you go into the workplace. So I, my message is to women as soon as they're starting their working lives, and they need to start building the muscle, you know, and getting in training to do this, because it's not so hard, I think, in your 20s and early 30s, but it drops off a cliff, your negotiating power, as soon as you, it becomes very difficult for women, obviously, as we all know. With the operation of the motherhood penalty when they become, you know, either parents or when their boss looks at them and says, you're the age of a potential, you know, of a potential parent. And the evidence is all out there. I discuss it at length, that the, you know, the structural problem of this motherhood penalty, which actually afflicts not just mothers, but women who look as if they might become mothers. So in answer to your question, I think you have to be in training. You have to know the risk is there. You have to be vigilant all the way through your life. Get confident. You know, we're so inhibited, a lot of us. Certainly I was. I didn't really have this conversation until I went off to do that China job. I just assumed that the law would protect me, that my boss was an ethical, you know, my employer was ethical, that they wouldn't want to do this. I think I was too trusting of the protections that I might have as a result of an ethical workplace, the law on equal pay, and the fact that, you know, we're living in the 21st century. I just trusted too much. And I really want to say to women, no, you can't afford to trust this environment. Your boss may be ethical, but frankly, you know, there are all kinds of things about the pay structure that means it by its inbuilt bias, baked in bias of decades towards paying more men more often. And so start early, start as you mean to go on, try to add up all the things that, that add value to your work, try to make sure your boss knows them, always make sure a new boss has your CV and knows the full range of your experience and your skills and all that you can offer. And then just keep going and make sure that your boss knows that equal pay matters to you. I mean, the law is there, and the law doesn't matter enough in our workplaces at the moment. I mean, you started, Harriet, by talking about the gender pay gap. I mean, 2/3 of the gender pay gap in this country is unexplained. And in some countries, I mean, the unexplained element of gender pay gap is enormous across all developed economies. And that is where the dirty secret of unequal pay is hiding. I mean, I'm not saying it's the whole of, I'm not saying for a minute there's the whole of the unexplained pay gap, but I believe it's a significant part. And so being confident, being assertive, knowing what you're contributing, making sure that the gender pay gap does not open up for you. We don't have a good enough cure at the moment. The law doesn't operate well enough. It's too expensive. I mean, this is something, again, when I contemplated, I believe I only won my case because I was determined to go to law at the end. And I think my employer felt, oh my gosh, she is mad, bad and dangerous enough to actually do this thing, despite the fact that it's career suicide often. It's financial suicide. I mean, it's because it's going to cost you so much to get to court. It's going to damage your mental health. Every woman I know who has gone to employment tribunal to fight this battle has talked about the mental health damage it's cost them.
So basically, mad, bad and dangerous to me equals badass. And there's a point in, so chapter 6 in the book, you've got a piece here that talks about the art of war. Let your plans be dark and impenetrable as night, and when you move, fall like a thunderbolt. You were on the Today programme, your letters coming out in the Times. What the hell were you thinking at that moment? As in, were you like, this is about to...
Yeah, I mean, it was a crazy 24 hours or so. In fact, it was a crazy week because it was also the week that... It was the week that began with all of that that you described. It was the week that ended with John Sopel and John Humphreys kind of in that tape and all that stuff going down. On the night that I, you know, that I was planning the letter coming out and I was going to be presenting the Today programme the next day, and then when I was going in to present the Today programme, I was like... oh, what am I doing? I was in free fall.
Yeah.
I was proud of all of us. I was proud that I had not taken this nonsense lying down.
Yeah.
I was proud of all the women who were getting ready to stand behind me.
Did other people know the thunderbolt was coming, or were you the only one that knew the thunderbolt?
No, other women. I mean, when you get a chance to read the book, in I do set it all out. Like I had a group around me who were, you know, close formation, Roman army tortoise, all ready to go, and then the wider BBC women group. But even saying all that, so I had phenomenal support. I had a great lawyer. Mm. I had my union behind me. I had these amazing BBC women behind me. I had a lot of, support from great men who wanted to help because they knew that women need help to do this. So and yet, it was a frightening and lonely thing to do in despite of all of that. And so I really feel for women who have to do it on their own, which is why I gave the money away to the Fawcett Society to set up the Equal Pay Advice Service to provide free legal advice for women in low-paid jobs without union support, because I knew how terrifying and isolating and belittling and, and gaslighting, those experiences are. But one thing I would say, that moment in the Today studio, just before the lights went green and we went to speak to the nation, me and John Humphreys for 3 hours of, crazy radio, I felt very small. And then, and this is important, I think, for all women, I got lucky. The universe just smiled at me because the Prime Minister was revamping her cabinet, bringing in more women. And so there was a kind of the top news story was about, refreshing what they described as a pale male stale cabinet. The second story was the Golden Globes. And there was a clip of Oprah Winfrey. And she was going, in her absolute inimitable, powerful voice, time's up, speak your truth. And it was just like, I was sitting there feeling small in that studio. It's like, oh, thank you, Oprah. Yeah, you're right. Yeah. Let's do this thing. Yeah. And so that thing about, listening to an inspiring role model, female role model, when you as a woman are about to do something which is terrifying, listening to somebody who gives you strength just before you go do that thing, I think it's very helpful and we should all do it.
Carrie, listening I'm actually emotional about that. I get emotional when I think incredible women stand up for other women and change the world for all of us. And I do get very emotional about that. And I'm not going to apologise for that. Your book Equal is out now. It is all about this and the things you've learned since. If there is one lesson from the book that you could give to our audience today, what would it be?
Don't beat yourself up because you didn't start already. Start now. And don't beat yourself up if you don't get it right immediately, because if you stand up for yourself, even in a little small way, by saying to your boss, sometime this year I'd like to have a conversation about pay, even if you just do that, and even if the conversation doesn't go right, and even if you think you didn't handle it right, you're already doing something. Mm-hmm. And you're doing something for you, you're doing something for the women around you, you're doing something to honour the women who came before you, and you're doing something on behalf of all the women who come after you. So be proud of whatever the thing is that you can do, the smallest thing, even if you're just thinking about it, even if you're just writing it down to yourself that at some point you're going to do it, even if it's not today, this week, this year, make a start.
Carrie Gracie, thank you so much for joining us on Badass Women's Hour. You are everything we wanted you to be. You are our absolute heroine. Thank you so much for coming. That was the incredible Carrie Gracie. Coming up next, Mandy Reid talks about why we need a political party just for women and how women can actually change the political process. But we're going to talk now to a woman who wants to change some things, and we're very excited about that. Mandy Reid, leader of the Women's Equality Party, welcome to Badass Women's Hour.
Hi, thank you very much. Thank you so much for having me.
We've just been chatting about the advertising stereotypes, but we're going to get your view quickly. What do you think? Do you think it's going to help?
What, changing the... Yes, of course it will. I was with some senior folks from Unilever earlier this week, and they reach every single day 2 billion people around the world with all of the content they put out to support and promote their products. And, young kids, that's often their first exposure they get to what norms are. And so, of course, it creates a kind of climate where the impressions and ambitions and imagination people have around what's possible for them in their life, they have huge power and influence over that. So it's a big deal. We mustn't underestimate how important this is. I was celebrating this week when that kind of news came to the fore.
Fingers crossed it makes a difference. I really hope so. Now, Amanda, you are the leader of the Women's Equality Party. Here at Badass Women's Hour, all three of us, me, Emma and Amanda, we are all paid up members of the Women's Equality Party. We love it.
My kind of women.
But I feel like not enough people out there know you, know who you are, know what you do. So tell us a little bit about the history of the Women's Equality Party and then what it aims to do.
So we are kind of new kids on the block when it comes to politics in Britain. We're only 4 years old, and we were founded because it was pretty clear when you looked at the political establishment that there wasn't enough ambition from any of the major political parties and not enough of the major politicians around gender equality. And so we exist really to create a scenario where we lead the way and show the main and major actors what they ought to be doing if they're serious about gender equality. And we're different from other political parties because a political party normally what it wants to do is perpetuate its existence into eternity. We don't want to do that. I would like to be lying on a beach in Barbados in 10 years because our work is done, because the other players out there have stepped up their game and taken the issues that we champion and we fight for a lot more seriously.
And you are the first black leader, not even the first black female leader, the first black leader of any UK political party.
That's right, any national political party. Yeah.
Why has it taken till 2019 for that to happen?
Well, it's straightforward, really. You know, we have across our culture, across our country, all sorts of, in some cases it's invisible, but structural inequality that makes it more difficult for people of certain backgrounds, certain demographic characteristics, be they women, be they people of colour, be they disabled people, makes it much more difficult for them to fulfil their potential. And so in my case, I am a black woman. And so there are at least two, facets of that inequality that would be working kind of against me having a smooth path towards some of the things that I want to achieve. And it really boils down to that. And I actually was a little bit nervous about kind of stepping up to this role because I didn't want it to be seen as a kind of tokenistic thing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I was anxious I'd be seen in that way. I was also anxious that it would be there would be a lot of hazards. You know, look at Diane Abbott, how much kind of grief she gets. And that primarily is because she is a black woman. But in the end, it feels right because linking to the discussion you were having earlier about advertising, I think having people visible doing things in places where they may not have been welcome or may not have been well represented actually is not window dressing. It's a huge deal and it sets an example. And so I'm going to try my best to set a good example.
How has it been for you so far? Because it is, I think you put yourself on a platform to really receive all the abuse, all the hate, all the difficult questions. Being a politician at the best of times is not a loved job. Being a politician of an emerging party that doesn't have huge amounts of support, huge amounts of money, huge platforms to talk about, and a black woman, all of this altogether, how are you dealing with all that?
Well, I have a kind of cocktail of emotions around it. Contradictory emotions in some respects. You know, on the one hand, I do feel humbled and I feel proud. And those things are contradictory, right? On the other hand, there are things that I'm frustrated about because our party is, we're a small party, but a growing party. And we actually don't get the airtime we deserve, yep. I would argue.
Mm. I would agree.
I want to do a comparison between, our party and another party that tried to kind of, make its mark recently, mm-hmm. Change UK, right? Yep. Change UK had an abundance of resources that completely dwarfs what we have ever had, an abundance of press and airtime. And look how they've kind of fizzled out into nothing. Here we are, 4 years later, still influencing. So on the one hand, I have a little bit of frustration because the establishment and the systems that govern how politics is choreographed in this country work against us. We have to struggle and grapple to get airtime for the things we're fighting for. So that is frustrating. But on the other hand, I'm really proud that despite all those things, we've already had an immense influence. And we've done that on a shoestring. We've done that on the strength and passion and energy and commitment of our activists, of our people up and down the country. 4 years, we've got 75 branches. We've got tens of thousands of registered supporters and members. And so, actually, imagine if we did have the resources and press time an entity like Change UK or the Brexit Party had. Imagine how quickly we could do the work that needs to be done to close the gender inequality gap. And I can go lie on the beach in Barbados.
Are there any examples, Andy, where you've started a conversation that the mainstream parties have had to pick up and act on because you're raising the conversation?
Yeah, there are a couple of examples of that. One example is the electoral contest for the Liverpool Metro Mayor. We put our candidate in the mix for that. Brilliant woman. Get her on here, Tabitha Morton. Now, what she did was she made sure that the issue of ending violence against women and girls, domestic violence, was centered in her campaign. She gave it airtime. She stood up and spoke passionately about that every opportunity she got during the campaign. And what happened was Steve Rotherham, who was the Labour candidate, who was kind of a shoo-in. It's a, you know, Labour do well in Liverpool, in that area, Merseyside. And so what happened was he started talking about it, but that wasn't his plan A. He thought, hang on a minute, there's a threat here, and I may well hemorrhage particularly women voters if I don't pick this up. Not only, and credit to him, not only did he start talking about it in the campaign, when he was elected, he brought Tabitha in, and together they developed a citywide strategy to tackle that issue that's funded and made a huge difference. If it wasn't for us, that issue would have not been surfaced during the campaign. Another example, at the last Labour Party conference, Jeremy Corbyn's flagship announcement, I mean, this is unprecedented, his flagship announcement was all about childcare. I mean, I give him a B- for it because it wasn't ambitious enough. If he wants to know what needs to be done, plagiarise our damn manifesto. It's all there. But hey, his flagship announcement was all about childcare, yeah? And that sort of thing, I think, is partly the result of us raising the profile of these issues and showing that it's politically expedient for those who do have power to take it on. And one last example, I've got to give you this example. Every time we stand, what we kind of see happening is that there's a higher probability of the other parties, because we like to announce our candidacies as early as we can, there's a higher probability of the other parties standing women, right? So that by itself creates significant movement towards one of our major goals, which is equal representation. They do that because of the threat we potentially pose. To neutralise the impact we have, they are more likely to put women up. That's what happened in the campaign I contested last year, the parliamentary by-election in Lewisham East. That's what happened. In fact, it was... Yeah, so those are three pretty solid examples, I think, of how we actually do have an influence.
Can I ask, Women's Equality Party, obviously when it launched, everyone, why has it got women in the title? Yeah. Is it just about women?
Where's the Men's Equality Party?
No. Would you ever stand a male candidate?
When the representation in across politics is sorted out, why not? Let's talk about it then. But for now, while we have a situation where women are outnumbered 2-1 in Parliament, and you know the figures are even worse when you look at kind of local government representation, it wouldn't make sense. One of our goals is equal representation. I want men in this party though, and I want men who see this as a problem and are prepared to fight alongside us to change it. And when they've done that legwork, and when we've got equal representation, we may well stand men as candidates. Who knows? But I think we're a long way off that.
Fabulous. We're going to keep talking to Mandy here on Badass Women's Hour XL.
Badass Women's Hour XL on Talk Radio.
She'll get you talking.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra.
Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, everyone. I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
We are talking to Mandy Reid, leader of the Women's Equality Party. Mandy, before the break, we were talking about the way that the Women's Equality Party has influenced the policies of some of the other parties. Is your goal to influence or is it to obtain power?
It's a bit of both, of course. As I say, because we're smaller and have less resources than some of the big players out there, we do have to an extent, resort to guerrilla tactics. Yeah. And we're operating in a system that's heavily stacked against us. So in a kind of parliamentary contest where it's first past the post, it is very difficult for us. Yeah. I mean, look how hard the Greens had to fight to win their one seat, and look how hard they have to fight to keep hold of that seat. But of course we will contest for all the reasons I've already explained, because we do exert an influence. But there are situations, for example, May next year, London 2020, that is a proportional representation system in London to elect the mayor and the London Assembly. We're going to win a seat then.
Yeah.
And we nearly did. We were 6 months old the last time we contested. Yeah. We had no name recognition and we got within a whisker. UKIP have two seats on the London Assembly and they're not going to hold on to those seats.
Yeah.
Another thing I want to say though on that is we have elected our very first, we have had the first Women's Equality Party elected official in place. So I want to give it up for Kay Wesley in Congleton, who was elected at the last local elections, and she has already made a blistering start to kind of influencing, changing things and shaking things up in East Cheshire.
That's amazing. I think it's so interesting when we think about politics to think that it is all just at that kind of top senior level and not to realise actually the influence and difference you can make through local government local elections. I have to also ask you about the Tory leadership race, because I opened the paper this morning and I was confronted with this. I think we're currently on six candidates. It might have changed in between then and now, who knows. And they were all men.
Yep.
There was only one man who was not a white man. And I looked at it, and they'd all been, I think with the exception of one, they've all been to public school with, they've all been through the same university system. How do you think we even begin to change politics when that is still the dominant background of people, when it is still dominated by white men who have been to private schools, who have been to top-tier universities, and they're just bringing their mates in, left, right and centre? It felt, when I saw that picture, I felt depressed by our political system. Is
yeah,
it going to change?
Tell me
what's
about
your
it.
View on it?
Well, what do we do about it? I think we have to hold our nerve. We really have to. And what I mean by that is we have to stick to what we think is right and what really matters rather than what is convenient. Because when it comes down to it, there is a kind of long established tradition of who wields power, who holds on to power in this country. That doesn't dissolve itself overnight. And my God, does it cling. But what I believe is that even when there's the temptation to kind of shift towards something that, like, change our name to just the Equality yeah. Party, or shift towards something that looks like it might make us more palatable, I think that is actually what the system wants us to do. Nothing would make Boris Johnson and all those folks on that list of candidates happier than if we started to kind of compromise and melt into the status quo they are clinging onto so desperately. Yeah. So I think we're at a stage now, and I want to say this because there are reasons to be optimistic, even though it feels very bleak and glum and dark and miserable yeah. when you look at politics in this country. The old status quo, I believe, is fracturing. It is in an advanced state of disintegration. These divisions within the Tory party, within the Labour party, have reached this kind of crisis point. And I wouldn't be surprised if there isn't some serious fracturing that happens over the next 12 months. We need to be there, and we will be there, to be a positive influence when all that kind of chaos starts to take hold.
How do you feel about the idea, though, of Boris Johnson as Prime Minister?
I feel really depressed at that prospect because, you know, the office of Prime Minister is... It's the highest political seat in the land and one of the most influential kind of political roles in the world. Britain hasn't yep. quite yet vanished into total irrelevance, but who knows what will happen with Brexit and how that kind of pans out. So for me, to have somebody who... has demonstrated time and time again that they have a kind of total disregard for the dignity of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people around the world by the comments that they've made, mm-hmm. Who has prioritized time and time again their own kind of political career over the people they're supposedly supposed to represent. I do feel really disappointed. But on the other hand, the advantage having someone like him in post gives people like us is you can no longer hide behind this thing of plausible deniability. Because yep. a lot of people say, oh, is it really needed? Do you really need parties like you doing what you do? And I always say yes, but this actually makes the case for us in nice shorthand. If people like that can wield power, he's never kind of really apologized. In fact, this week when he was confronted by the journalist at the launch of his conference, he just said, people really want to know, don't they, what politicians think. So he reinforced the fact that some of those terrible things he says are his true view. So on the other hand, it means people who might be a bit iffy about whether there really is disadvantage in this country, injustice that needs to be tackled. He makes the point for us that, of course, there damn well is. And so work needs to be done. Come and join us to actually take that fight to the people who are clinging on to the old status quo.
We've talked a lot tonight about that sort of the typical background, the typical kind of politicians and you as the party being the disruptors. What's been your background to get you into the position that you are now? Have mm-hmm. you come through... I mean, I know little about, you know, the road to get you to politics, but we know that a lot of them come from the same kind of journey. What's been your background to get into politics?
First of all, I really didn't expect to... I'm 38 years old, to find myself doing what I'm doing right now. That was not something I would have predicted. However, I grew up in Southern Africa in the shadow of apartheid South Africa. My mum's black, my dad's white, and the existence of our family was politically significant because of that. And so from a young age, the idea of injustice being a very kind of poignant, obvious, in-your-face thing that needs to be challenged was just part of my makeup. I'll confess that, and this may be weird as the leader of the Women's Equality Party, I was a kind of late developer when it comes to feminism. I was much more tuned into the kind of inequality from the point of view of racial inequality, and it took me until my mid-20s to really appreciate that, my God, there's work to do on the gender inequality front, and there's probably a lot more work to do when you look at it from some perspectives. And then some personal experiences really influenced my journey. I was a member of the Labour Party for a short while. In 2010, I joined the Labour Party and tried to get involved locally, but that didn't work for me. I joined because I knew what would happen with austerity, and I was terrified of the havoc that would wreak, and I wanted to be part of tackling it. Anyway, never mind that. After my experience in the Labour Party, I vowed never to join a political party. When I was 33, I got pregnant, and it wasn't planned, and the dad was a little bit younger than me, and we had conversations about what to do. And it's strange to say it, but neither of us could imagine a situation where I wasn't going to be the sole or main caregiver of the child. Neither of us could even imagine that when we were discussing how to deal with this. And what that, in the end, I wanted to pursue some of my career ambitions. I crunched the numbers. I looked at the cost of having a young child in full-time childcare in London. It's about 20 grand a year, mm-hmm. 5 days a week, 10 hours a day. That wasn't going to be compatible with my kind of plans for my career, my ambitions, the potential in myself that I wanted to fulfill. So I had an abortion. And actually, when I discovered the Women's Equality Party and I learned about the policies we're fighting for in relation to equal parenting and caregiving, I realized that this isn't just interesting. This is something that I've got to get involved in and involved in a hands-on way. Because if those policies were the real deal, if those were the law, I could have made a different decision when I was age 33 and be able to balance the things that I wanted to balance. And possibly all this stuff about stereotypes and whatever else, if we were further along with that, maybe me and this man would have been able to imagine him having a more hands-on role, you know? So it's a huge deal. Some of these things that look like they're just surface, they are not surface. And so for me, I joined the Women's Equality Party because I saw in our manifesto something that would have been transformative for me and no doubt transformative for millions of women and men all around the country. And so it was really that propelled me, and here I am today.
We're so pleased you are. If people want to join the Women's Equality Party, one thing I will say is you can join the Women's Equality Party and be a member of another political party. Oh, no one else lets you do that.
No, I have no problem with political promiscuity, actually. That does make us different from some of the other parties. We will work with people that share our values, but if they have some other stuff that they're also committed to, other allegiances, whatever.
Yeah. You absolutely should. Where can people find out more about the Women's Equality Party?
They can go to our website, of course, womensequalityparty.org.uk, or you can come to a party we're having on the 27th of June. Sandy Toksvig is doing her one-woman show at the Hackney Empire. It's a Amazing. Fundraiser for the Women's Equality Party, but she's funny, so you'll get to have a laugh as well as contributing to our mission to kind of consign gender inequality to the dustbin of history. So Come to that. I'll be there.
Mandy, thank you so much for coming in and chatting to us. We've loved having you. Mandy Reid, leader of the Women's Equality Party. Before you go, who would you want to win the Tory leadership race? Is there anyone?
I can't. That is a poison chalice. You know what? Yeah. I thought Matt Hancock was the best of a bad bunch, but he's bowed out now. I'm disappointed because I could just about have stomached him being in charge. Jeremy Hunt? No, zero. I'm sorry, I refuse to kind of pledge allegiance to any of those.
Beautiful. Thank you so much for joining us.
1, 2, 3, 4!
That's all from this week's show. We'll be back next week as normal with yet more badass women. If you like the show, please subscribe, review, give us 5 stars. It makes such a difference and we will love you forever.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.